Faber and Faber, The Untold Story, is one man's tale of the work of his father and grandfather. Toby Faber, grandson of the firm's founders, has used correspondence from the company's archive to give us an insider's look at the venerable publisher, whose writers include T.S. Eliot, Seamus Heaney, Samuel Beckett, Peter Carey and Kazuo Ishiguro, to name but a few. Toby Faber joins me now from London. Your grandfather, Toby, it was who started what we now know as Faber and Faber back in the 1920s. What sent him towards the world of publishing back then, do you think?
I think he thought it would be a nice, congenial activity for a young man. I mean, he'd fought in the war, so he'd obviously had his share of trauma. He came back, he became a prize fellow of All Souls College, Oxford, which I suppose show his intellectual credentials. And then he'd actually gone to work in a family brewing business. Strong Breweries was based down in Hampshire. But that only lasted for a couple of years. Essentially, he was sacked. He wasn't good as a brewer. And by then he was married. He had children. He certainly needed to earn some money somehow. And it was through his All Souls connections that he made contact with the Guires, who essentially owned this company, the Scientific Press.
He wanted to earn money somehow. Now, the opening line, I think, of your introduction says, if you want to make a small fortune, it's an old joke, if you want to make a small fortune in publishing, make sure you start out with a big one. You'll have a small fortune in no time. Now, your grandfather wanted to make some money. His mother, your great-grandmother, was not at all enamoured of his thoughts of moving towards the publishing world.
No, she thought it was a very risky venture.
She was probably right. I think you'd agree.
She wasn't, and the reason she wasn't was because the company he bought into owned this magazine called The Nursing Mirror, which was then, and I think probably still is, a very profitable thing. And that's slightly different from the sort of trade publishing he was trying to move Faber and Guire onto. But so The Nursing Mirror gave it a cash flow basis, and indeed meant that he got a very good deal when he bought into it.
So the Faber and Guire, though, that partnership, it didn't last that long, really, and was it quite an acrimonious end, ultimately?
It certainly was, I'm afraid. Rather sadly, really, because they'd started off with such great intentions, the two of them together. Geoffrey was trying to turn this company into a trade publisher, and you've just said the joke, that is not a profitable thing to do. So all that money from the Nursing Mirror was being ploughed back into building up this trade list with, as you say, authors like T.S. Eliot and Ezra Pound, who were, let's say, long-term investments at the very best at that stage. The Guires couldn't see any prospect of that making any money, and my grandfather, they did fall out quite spectacularly.
Now, so he decides to let go of this trade magazine, which, as you say, might have had a kind of an element of cash cow to it. Now he's in the thorny and difficult business of publishing, and he's going to publish mostly poetry, thanks to, I suppose, the presence of T.S. Eliot.
Well, it's the poetry that he's most famous for publishing, but I mean, you're right, that would never have kept a firm going in the 1930s, so they publish all sorts of other things, which you know, we no longer know, which are no longer on the backlist, we no longer read, but they were different sort of books that kept the firm going in the 1930s.
But I suppose the big breakthrough, really, wasn't it, was Ezra Pound, poems of his when they were published in 1928, and Siegfried Sassoon's memoirs of the fox hunting man.
Well, that was the first bestseller, yes, and I think that was really important, because that really showed that this young firm, which was then only 4 years old, it really could publish a bestseller. And that's part of what gave them the confidence to turn Faber and Guire into Faber and Faber the following year. As you say, they sold the Nursing Mirror. My grandfather made enough money to buy out the Guires. And that, from that point on, he was in sole control. He had a really good team around him, and it motors. It's amazing how quickly you can see the firm start to take off.
Of course, it would have to be somebody like James Joyce who would get Faber and Faber, and with the flick of his pen very quickly turn it into Feebler and Fumbler. That's how he referred to Faber and Faber, wasn't it? So what was the relationship with James Joyce, with your grandfather? Because as we know, initially it was very difficult for Joyce to have anything published because it was considered totally obscene what he was doing. Obscenity was a big deal.
He was. I mean, so the Ulysses, of course, had already become a big deal, but entirely overseas in the 1920s. And through that, James Joyce had got to know T.S. Eliot. And T.S. Eliot was almost my grandfather's first employee. So he was the literary editor of Faber and Faber. And of course, Eliot and my grandfather, they desperately wanted to publish Ulysses. They got all sorts of legal advice about it. And they were advised that if the firm published Ulysses, it would almost certainly be prosecuted for obscenity. And if there was a prosecution for obscenity, then the chairman would be sent to prison for 6 months. And so they did not publish Ulysses because my grandfather didn't fancy that idea. Bodleyhead were braver. They were braver in 1934. They leapt in and published it, and they weren't prosecuted. So, yes, that's part of the reason why Joyce... I mean, Joyce stuck with Faber's, and we published lots of his other work, but we did not publish Ulysses.
Yeah, and Finnegan's Wake was published by Faber. We would have to grant you that. And that was published in fragments. Was it published in fragments initially, or when was it published fully?
Yeah, that's right. It was published in fragments. So for the first decade of its life, Finnegan's Wake was called Work in Progress. And we published fragments of Work in Progress. And it was the way we published one of those fragments. We didn't even bother to send out review copies, apparently, that led him to call us Feebler and Fumbler. And then in 1938, finally the full manuscript is delivered. He calls it Finnegan's Wake, and that's when we publish it. And of course, that is again one of the defining books from Faber's decade.
Yeah, absolutely. Although I love this, and I don't know who wrote this, perhaps it was your grandfather. This is from the 1949 catalogue. We shall not attempt to describe James Joyce's masterpiece, but we have pleasure in announcing that it is once more available.
Yeah, that was T.S. Eliot, actually.
Oh, it was Eliot, was it?
Since I wrote the book, actually, I've come across a letter from T.S. Eliot in which he says he's never read Finnegan's Wake. So he was the editor of Finnegan's
Wake.
Oh, the
big bluff.
And he'd never read it.
But he was prepared to. That's why he wasn't going to attempt to describe it.
That's why he doesn't describe it, exactly.
Yeah, well, of course, he was a man of great restraint. But you talk about Bodleyhead are being potentially braver when it came to the publishing of Ulysses. But let's go to George Orwell. And T.S. Eliot here, I mean, and the sections, the discussion around Orwell's work is quite interesting because there were a couple of attempts down and out in Paris and London. That was just basically rejected from the outset, was it?
It was. And I mean, of course, that was early in Orwell's career.
Yeah. Right?
He was still Eric Blair at that stage. Mm. And I think you can understand it, can't you? You get this rather bitty manuscript. You like the writing, but it's got two very disparate parts to it. It's a bit short. You say, sorry, it doesn't work for us. And that's what happened. I mean, now, in retrospect, you can say...
Oh, yeah, it's very easy to be wise now. We all know that you should have got that because then you would have... But the decision around Animal Farm... This is an interesting one, which I don't know how. Is it cowardice was involved here? Is that too strong? Political cowardice, or does it maybe tell us where your grandfather's and T.S. Eliot's political allegiances lay?
You might call it political cowardice. I think, I mean, Eliot is rejecting it in a letter to Orwell. It's in 1944. He is absolutely clear in the letter that he thinks the writing's really good.
This is Animal Farm we're talking about.
Animal Farm,
now, yeah.
And he's very sad to be rejecting it, because as he says, I realise in rejecting it, I'm rejecting your future work also. And that sends a knife to my heart, because of course that includes 1984.
Yeah.
Anyway, but he says the reason we are rejecting is because we don't think now is the right time at which to criticise the political situation. And he's basically saying, you're being rude in this book about Soviet Russia. Soviet Russia are our allies in 1944. This isn't the right time to do it. No, of course, with the benefit of hindsight, you can say you wish he hadn't done that.
Yeah.
But I have sympathy for him, actually.
Yeah, and I suppose I don't know how aware he was of letting himself out of the gap by saying, I am aware that in doing this, we're rejecting, we will not get our hands on any of your future work. Would that simply be because, I think, was that the third rejection he had? I think there might have been down and out in Paris and London. Was there another one in
between? No, I think it was just the second. I think, generally, of course, I mean, the Faber policy is once you acquire an author, you acquire not just the book, but you acquire them for their life if they want to stick with you. And I guess that applies in reverse as well.
Another very interesting story is bring it a bit closer to home, is John McGahern. Now, we have to move on a bit in the story in this one, because we're into the 1960s. I suppose, was your father deeply involved at this time?
Not by that time, no. My father would still have been a young man.
Yeah, right.
But so my grandfather has died by then.
Right.
So there's no real member of the family involved at that stage. But it's Charles Monteith, the great editor who had been recruited by my grandfather, who has the correspondence with McGahern that I think you're about to talk about.
Yes, yeah. And this is regarding the barracks. So tell us what the problems were with the barracks, please.
Are we after the watershed?
Well, you can tell. Look, this is in. It's like everything else. You're reporting what the problems were.
I'm reporting.
These
what
are
the
not your
were.
Words necessarily.
So John McGahern has written The Barracks. It's his first book. He's a young school teacher in Ireland at the time. It's won a prize. It's won the first half of it has won a prize, the AE Prize. So it's already had some acceptance from the Irish literary establishment. He writes this book, and Charles Monteith writes back to him saying, really good. I love it. I just do feel I need to say that some of the language in it, and I think at that stage Monteith is not specific, some of the language in it, we don't think we get prosecuted for it anymore. And of course that's a new thing. That's fairly recent, just after Lady Chatterley. But some of the provincial libraries, I think he says, and also the Republic of Ireland will ban it. And you've just got to...
Why, Toby? Why would they be banning it now?
And so McGowan writes back, I think I can take out quite a few of the fuckings, but not all of them.
Yeah. And it was, and we're not talking about the action there, we're talking about the actual word.
It's the actual word, which he, in the end, I think he comes down that there are four points where he simply can't remove it, because he needs to leave it in the language to give the language the power it requires.
However, he was totally aghast and appalled, I think, when he got... Were we at the stage of galleys at this stage, but where he got an early draft and what had happened to his beloved fuckings?
They'd been F*****'d.
Oh, dear. It's like a bleep on air, isn't it, really? It's not the thing.
And so he writes back to Monteith. And Monteith, and I think the Faber board, they feel they've been quite brave in saying, OK, you can go ahead with your fuckings. And they write to the printers and say, no, we really do mean these to stay. They should stay.
And so they did, and the story goes on from there. Obviously, in the case of John McGowan, let's go back a bit in terms again back in time, because again it's words that cause a problem here. I wonder is this a specifically Hiberno English problem? If we think maybe there's a bit of the French problem mixed in when we talk about Beckett, the original publication of Waiting for Godot, the Lord Chamberlain edition. That Lord Chamberlain thing, maybe you could explain that to us. That's quite an old thing. British censorship is what we're talking about,
British,
isn't it?
And it's amazing to think it was still such a big thing in the 50s and right on into the 60s. Mm. But, of course, Waiting for Godot had been performed as a play in London.
Yeah.
And as a play in London, it had to be passed by the Lord Chamberlain. The Lord Chamberlain could censor things. And so he had demanded the removal of a number of words.
Ah, go on, Toby, tell us what words.
Well, I don't have it open in front of me, but I can remember. So the reason we know is because a few years later, finally we feel we can publish the unexpurgated edition, and Beckett, just as sort of housekeeping, writes to us saying, this is the edition I want. These, as far as I can remember, the words that the Lord Chamberlain objected to, and they are... pubis, erection, balanced, clap, farted. I mean, lots of words that you kind of think, yeah.
Yeah, button it, erection.
Button it,
you know,
yes.
Okay, farted. But even farted, you know, it gives us a sense of just how controlled things were in the publishing world,
It was another world. I mean, and even in the 60s, we're getting a lawyer, when we're publishing Joyce's letters, a lawyer writing to us saying some of the activities described will... pervert the minds of young undergraduates, so you can't use them.
There's the young undergraduates that were worried about it. And that. Although I think if we went to Death of a Naturalist and Seamus Heaney, I am pretty certain in the title poem that we might find the word farted in there, if I remember it correctly. How did the connection with Seamus Heaney come about? Because in an unusual case, this one really, you sought him, as in Faber and Faber sought him, rather than the other way around.
This is just
a
lovely story.
That's a source of great pride, I would have thought.
It's just a lovely story. And the sort of context for it, and this is what I love, well, it's a sad context, is Eliot has been the presiding genius of the Faber poetry list from the 1920s right up until the 1960s. I mean, he even acquires Ted Hughes. And then, of course, he dies in January 1965. 10 days after he dies is the first letter from Charles Monteith to Seamus Heaney saying, I've read some of your poems in The New Statesman. I think you're great. I've looked at some of your other poems. Not quite right for a collection yet, but we're really interested. When you've got enough poems for a collection, please get in touch. So that's only 10. That's 10 days after Eliot dies.
I know.
And Seamus always used to say he couldn't believe getting a letter from Faber and Faber. It was like receiving a letter from Almighty God.
Yeah.
Because of our poetry reputation, of course. By the time Seamus died, he was God to all of us. But that's
another day's work, of course. Yeah. God to many people, I think, in this country would agree with you on that particular aspect. And of course, Seamus Heaney effectively brought brought Paul Muldoon to you in time as well.
He did indeed. I love this chain, actually. It's just part of what gives the book its power, I think.
You know, the fact that you were going back to... Because this, I don't know if I've explained properly that what we get in the book, that essentially your input into it here is, as an editor, Toby, you've... short contextual passages that you give us maybe at the beginning of each time period to kind of put things into some kind of context, as they say, and then every so often a little italicised bit that will explain some correspondence that we've seen ahead of that. Going back on your grandfather's, and I know your father maybe wasn't as... Was he as hands-on involved as your grandfather?
Not at all.
Not really.
He was a physicist, my father. That was his business.
But he was a director, wasn't involved in the day-to-day business. But going back and looking at those, you know, those correspondences, in some cases by, you know, demigods of the literary establishment, let's be honest, but members of your family, what was that experience like?
I can't tell you what fun I had doing this book. I loved it. I had such a good time. So my grandfather died before I was born. I'd never really known him that well. I've read an awful lot of his correspondence and his diaries, and I've really got to know him. My grandmother, I remember, is a lovely person, but it was lovely seeing some of her correspondence again. And then my father, I mean, when you're a child, of course, you observe your parents possibly worrying about things at the dinner table, that sort of thing. It's only when that I go back and read this correspondence and I realise how close the firm came to going under in 1970, when I would have been four. And
what were the particulars of that close sinking?
Well, we'd overexpanded in the 1960s, and we'd been eating our way through cash. And in 1970, the bank said, nope, we won't allow the overdraft to go up anymore. And basically, the entire board almost, including my father, had come to accept that we would have to sell the business, probably to Penguin Longman. And the unlikely hero of that story is my grandfather's solicitor, who was a trustee of the family trust, who said, no, this is not the right time to do it. The firm is basically sound. You've just got to mobilise all your resources that you can to keep it going. And so we did. And obviously very glad that we did.
Yeah, and clearly it must have been quite an emotional experience for you in many ways. This is the untold story, Toby. How many totally untellable bits were there that you didn't put into the untold story?
Well, funnily enough, none really. I mean, because it's... I mean, I do end the story in 1990.
Yeah.
There's a reason for that in terms of the narrative, which is that that's when we lock in the independence of the firm. And if there's an overall story to what I'm trying to tell, obviously you've got the great individual stories, but the overall story is how come this firm is still independent.
All right, so we'll get the rest of the untold story as volume two, perhaps.
Perhaps you will.
Toby Faber then, Toby Faber there, author of Faber and Faber, The Untold Story, which obviously is published by Faber.